It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The hottest product that flew off the shelves this holiday season wasn't a new game or electronic device. The must-have commodity that had consumers racing to the store is a cup. Yes, a large insulated cup with a handle under the brand name Stanley. Not to be confused with the trophy awarded to the NHL champion hockey team, the Stanley Cup has gone viral on social media with videos of Black Friday-like frenzies for special edition cups. They seem to be a good quality product, but the popularity of these cups seems to go way beyond their functional value. It's just the latest example of a long line of consumer crazes that seem to come out of nowhere and can fade away just as fast. Our next guest studies the social influences that drive these purchases and how consumers express themselves and their identities through products like these. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Now, have you seen a social media post or other stories about these Stanley-made cups? What do you think about them? Did you go out and get one for yourself, or was it on your gift list for somebody? Do you remember another product craze from the past that either you participated in or wondered why the heck everybody else was? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Catherine Dew is an assistant professor of marketing at UW-Milwaukee, where she researches consumer psychology and behavior. Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you study these kind of consumer crazes. Now, do you kind of keep your distance, or do you get swept up in the wave when a new product like this comes along? Or do you feel like, you know, since you study it, you got to go out and try it yourself?
It really depends on the craze. I'm certainly susceptible myself, but other times I find myself resisting. So it's a mixed bag on my end. And I think that's true for a lot of consumers.
Now, with these cups, it sounds like they're perfectly fine products. But when we get something breakthrough as a fad like this, I assume there's something more going on than, yeah, it's a really good product. What is it that drives this kind of popularity?
I think there are so many factors contributing. I think the ones that are top of mind for me as a psychologist are, one, the motivating power of scarcity. They've leveraged scarcity-based promotions extremely well with the Stanley Cup craze, the immense way of social influence on human behavior, and also the idea of identity-based motivations, right? The idea, as you alluded to earlier, that products can really transcend their utilitarian value and come to represent something more that we can thus align with our identities and use to express ourselves. So I think in these crazes, typically a number of factors converge to really create the perfect storm of popularity.
Is there something just about, even if it's not a particularly expensive item, the idea that, as you mentioned, this is scarce, and by getting it, I can demonstrate to all around me that I have successfully obtained this scarce product. So I'm awesome.
Yeah. So while there are some limited exceptions, the literature on consumer psychology, by and large, finds that scarcity is a huge motivator of behavior. When something's scarce or limited, we tend to want it even more, right? That scarcity suggests that it has value. It's in demand by other people. And so then it also, in a way, becomes a status signaling good if you can get your hands on it, right? Because it is so difficult to obtain. And so that makes the product even more alluring to its target market.
Now, in my head, this is a social media thing going on, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But then I remember, you know, there were Beanie Babies crazes or Cabbage Patch crazes and things like that before there was social media. Pre-social media, how do we start to get this, I guess, feedback loop where people hear about this thing and then want to go seek it out, and that drives that scarcity even more?
I mean, human beings, even before social media existed, observed other human beings' behavior, right? Like, we are fundamentally relatively social creatures, right? Like, it's really been one of the mainstays of our survival as a species to be socially oriented, to seek approval from others, to observe what others are doing and conform to that or imitate it. So even before social media existed, there's always been crazes and trends because we're fundamentally social creatures. We're seeking to understand the norms of our social groups. We're seeking to belong into social groups. And so social influence has always been a factor, even when social media didn't exist.
Talking to Catherine Du, Assistant Professor of Marketing at UW-Milwaukee, looking at what drives particular products to become super popular, to motivate people to seek them out, maybe pay a premium for them. The latest example, these Stanley-made travel cups with the handle, and they're supposed to be pretty good, but they are just the latest in a long line of products. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions, you have thoughts on how this happens, if you've seen products go viral on social media or pre-social media, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, social media, TikTok has been a big part of this Stanley Cup thing. I want to give a listen to one. This is a user on TikTok named Danielle Lettering posting a video of her retrieving an unscathed cup, one of these Stanleys, from the wreckage of a car fire.
Everybody's so concerned about if the Stanley spills, but what about the milk? Fire yesterday still has ice in it.
I question the physics a little bit, but a lot of people, a lot of consumers are volunteering to do publicity for some brands. Some of them aren't volunteering. They might make money off of it in some way. Apparently this one, Stanley is going to buy Danielle a new car and new cups along the way. How we join in and jump on bandwagons, not just to buy the thing, but to help promote it on TikTok and elsewhere. Can you talk about that phenomenon, Catherine?
Yeah, there. First of all, I love this car fire example because it shows the functionality of these cups, and consumers love having functional alibis for purchasing seemingly maybe frivolous things. So this car fire example was so good for them because it shows that it does function really quite well. And then that gives consumers a really good reason to buy something that maybe they don't 100% need. Back to your original question, you know, I think consumers spread word of mouth. They talk about products, they talk about their consumptions for so many reasons. A lot of it is kind of an impression management based motive. You talk about what you buy and consume to display a certain image of yourself. We kind of use products like props, right? They help us form who we are. They help us affirm who we are and express who they are. And so I think part of why so many people are willing to promote this on social media is because that product is then a prop for them to express their own identity.
Okay, we heard that clip. Now the Stanley Company joining in from the brand's own TikTok account. Here's a listen.
Stanley is the GOAT of water bottles. The others are just trying to be Stanley.
I hear they only use recycled stainless steel.
I have two Stanleys, one in pink dusk and one in black glow.
I hear they even use them in Brazil.
Stanley's favorite is hydrating everyone.
One time, Stanley survived a car fire. It was awesome.
Brands, of course, have tried to jump on social media bandwagons to promote their own products with varying results. How do you see this working, Catherine? Stanley, I don't think, generated this craze, but they're seeming to try to jump onto it.
Yeah, they're certainly playing into the popularity in many ways through their marketing mix, and I think they're doing a relatively good job of that. I think a lot of the craze, though, has been so prominent because it originated from a somewhat more organic origin. Consumers are naturally relatively skeptical towards advertising and marketing, and we typically don't like to feel overtly pressured by brands to purchase. In fact, we often attempt to resist persuasion when we recognize that a persuasion attempt is occurring. And so the more organic consumer-driven forces can fuel popularity even more effectively than brands. And then brands can jump on those bandwagons with, you know, proper tactics and strategies like the example you've just played. So I think they've done a good job of tapping into the organic popularity without overriding it.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Liz is with us in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Liz?
I'm concerned on the other aspect of this. I saw a video where a girl, I think elementary school, wanted a Stanley cup to take to school, and her mom bought her one from Walmart, which is perfectly fine and functional. I don't care about those kind of things. And I don't think kids should have to care about that kind of thing either. But she took it to school, and the kids found out that it wasn't an actual Stanley Cup, and they, like, made fun of her and, like, you know, bullied her about it. Like, you can't afford it. I'm concerned about that aspect of it and why people are so concerned about name brand things.
Liz, thanks a lot for the call. Catherine, I don't think this is new. I remember people back in school in my day being made fun of for wearing, I don't know, the wrong pair of jeans or what have you. This goes to kids, and they're very conscious of these brand differences for some reason. Why?
Yeah, I think that kids are in a position in their life where they're socially really vulnerable, right? They're looking for social approval, and so they tap into brands as a means for that. And as much as brands can help us make social connections and belong with others, they can also help us ostracize others, right? They can also, as much as signal our in-groups, brands also create out-groups, right? And I do think that that's a concerning element of some of these trends, is that it can be affecting children's feelings of belongingness and self-esteem. So I certainly agree with that concern.
Liz, thanks for that call. We are talking to UW-Milwaukee marketing professor and consumer psychologist Catherine Dew about the popularity of these Stanley brand cups and how products like these and many others become the latest consumer craze and then maybe fade away in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think random products become so popular? How about these Stanley brand cups? What drove that? Did you encounter social media hype about these things? Demands? Begging from your kids to have one to take to school? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Catherine Dew. She's an assistant professor of marketing who studies consumer psychology at UW-Milwaukee. She's with us today to talk about how products become viral consumer fads, with the latest example being the popular insulated cups made by the company Stanley. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think products like these Stanley cups get so popular, these non-hockey related Stanley cups? What questions do you have for our expert? Do you have some firsthand experience to report to us if you've seen the hype, bought into the hype maybe? Join in at 800-642-1234. If you work at a store where these things are sold or have seen similar crazes in the past, love to hear your perspective. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. It seems like people are like Charlie the Tuna. They want to show they have good taste, but if they taste good, they'll be canned. As far as FOMO goes, it seems to relate to FOMO, but why isn't there a scarcity of FOMO?
Fear of missing out. Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. You know, at some point, Catherine, do we hit a saturation point where we have a fear of missing out, but then if everybody seems to have these things, does it seem special anymore?
I mean, in short, no, right? Once these products reach saturation, oftentimes that's when we see their popularity decline. The continued popularity versus decline of these hot products often relies on how many hands they're in and whose hand the product is in. Let's imagine, you know, kind of as we know, if lots of tough and rebellious people ride Harley motorcycles, then Harley becomes a symbol of that rugged identity. But if stuffy accountants and, you know, everybody on every corner starts riding a Harley, the meaning of the brand shifts, it changes, it gets diluted. And then those original users may say, well, why would I want this anymore? Then abandon the product, which allows them to avoid signaling some kind of unclear or undesirable identity. So research suggests that eventually this gets saturated, and these hot products typically face a decline when some, either too many people or kind of the wrong people, for lack of better words, get their hands on it.
Thanks for that call, Dennis, at 800-642-1234. Kelia joins us in Milwaukee now. Kelia, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I coach gymnastics, so I have a lot of young girls around me every evening, and the latest fad is the Stanley Cups. They used to be the Hydro Flasks, but now all the girls lately have these cups with straws, and I just don't get it.
And do you see, like, do you see it catching on? Like, first one of them shows up with it, and then everybody else has to have it?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, the way that the game works is you kind of coach girls years after year. So I see one fad happen and then the next. And I just ask them, what is the big hype about it? And can't really tell me anything other than everybody has it.
Yeah, I got to ask, with these girls, they have the Stanley Cups. Do they seem to work better? Like, are they good cups for young gymnasts or just as good as what they used to have?
I mean, honestly, we've banned them because they kind of they leak if they fall over on the floor at a gymnastics meet or something. So it's not that they work better. I think it's really just who has the best colors and who has how many and who's got it and who doesn't.
Kelia, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Now, Catherine, first of all, I mean, if I'm a smart marketing company, I'm going to call Kelia up right now to have my finger on the pulse. I mean, how do companies try to assess what the young gymnasts and other youth want these days?
Yeah, I think social media has made that a lot easier for them. I think they've been able to keep their pulse on these trends in much better ways without having to coach an entire gymnastics team because of that public consumption element that social media enables. So we are seeing them respond much more quickly to these trends than I think they had in the past. In the past, I think they had to actually have sort of trend spotters out there and have employees doing that kind of recon, if you will. So that's just given them one more tool in their toolbox to keep their pulse on things.
Thanks again for that call. We're talking to Catherine Du, assistant professor of marketing at UW-Milwaukee, about what makes a humble everyday product the big consumer craze like the Stanley-made cups are. Whether or not they're good for gymnastics class, I don't know. You could still join in at 800-642-1234. Catherine, I want to flip things around now. Now, kids, they're obviously exposed to a lot of marketing messages, either on social media or TV or at gymnastics practice or at school, whatever. Do you have thoughts on how parents can develop a media literacy for their kids and how to critically evaluate these claims they're hearing from marketers and their peers?
Oh, goodness. I feel like you'd have to. That's a huge show. Can of war. Yeah. Wait, how many hours do you have? I think parents keeping their pulse on these things, too, is really important. And then making their own individual decisions as to whether they want to allow their kids to buy into this, not, and how to manage that is really important. And so I think when parents are involved in social media as well, that helps them monitor these things. And also, I think maybe there's the added benefit that the more parents that are on social media, the less cool the social media becomes. But then the kids just find a new platform and the cat and mouse game continues. But
yeah, do you have thoughts on how parents, without making it seem uncool, can ride along on social media so that they're seeing what their kids are seeing?
Oh my gosh. No, I mean, I think that I hear a lot of parents using sort of covert accounts simply to observe, but not really participate. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that's how a lot of them achieve that.
I think we've got time for one more caller if we get them lined up here. Oh, no, not quite ready. Okay. So Catherine, what are you watching for now? Eventually, this Stanley Cup craze is going to go away. What are you watching for as we watch for the next whatever it is to emerge?
Oh, my gosh. I'm not even sure. I think, honestly, it's all being driven. Well, almost all being driven by TikTok these days. So I think if you're on TikTok and you start seeing things pop up, there's a pretty good likelihood that that's going to be the next thing. I think that platform has delivered content in a way that really just triggers dopamine in people's brains and allows them to be exposed to so many different influencers. And it's just absolutely setting fire to trends. So I'm not entirely sure what it'll be, but I will tell you to watch TikTok, and that's probably where it's going to come from.
Okay, we got our last caller ready now. Jameson is with us in Black River Falls. Jameson, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I got a really quick question for you guys. So it seems like both Stanley and previously Hydro Flask are like within the camp of personalizations that can be brought into schools. I was curious if like the marketing companies are identifying these based off the fact that it's a personalization or based off the fact that it falls within a certain price criteria, right? Like they're both kind of like moderately accessible in like the $30 to $50 range, I'm assuming, but is it mainly because like high schoolers and middle schoolers can buy these things and bring them, or is it because they're moderately affordable?
Interesting. Jameson, does price point matter, Catherine, on a craze, a fad product?
I think you hit two things that they've done really well. I think they're offering a price point that, while accessible, is still a bit of a status signal, right? Like a lot of these teens may be able to save up, you know, a couple hours worth of babysitting money and afford a $40 tumbler. But $40 for a tumbler is still relatively expensive. And perhaps not all teens are, of course, going to be able to spend their money in that way. So they're hitting this nail on the head where it's accessible while still signaling status. And in terms of the customization, I also think they're really hitting the nail on the head. So research suggests that we're often looking for a level of optimal distinctiveness, meaning we're often looking to fit in with our valued social groups while still having things for ourselves, things to be unique. So a lot of times what you'll see people doing is buying similar products to their social groups, but buying it with a unique color or a unique customization. And that scratches that itch to belong, this kind of fundamentally ingrained need to belong that human beings have, while also scratching the itch that we all also have of feeling unique and expressing our own unique identities. So I think both of those things, the customization and the price point element, have been really well tailored and also fuel this popularity. I think those are two really interesting observations.
Catherine, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Catherine Du, a consumer psychologist and assistant professor of marketing at UW-Milwaukee, with us today to talk about the latest viral consumer trend of buying these Stanley brand cups and how products like these over the years rise and fall in popularity. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. In December, Wisconsin lawmakers introduced a bill that calls for the Department of Public Instruction to develop a K-12 civics curriculum that emphasizes civic understanding, participation, and pride. It would also require Wisconsin high schoolers to take one half credit of civics instruction in order to graduate. Here's one of the bill's authors, Republican Representative Amanda Nedweski, during a public hearing last week.
The data shows that, yes, we're teaching social studies, yes, in some places these things may or may not be included, but clearly in surveying across the country, including the state, we have a lack of knowledge, and we can go back to the Colleges and Universities Committee where we often talk about the responses to the free speech survey throughout the UW system that occurred last year, and less than 50% of college students across the UW system reported having any education ever in a classroom on the First Amendment. I just feel like this is something that is supportive to the current social studies curriculum at the local level. It gives DPI a lot of freedom in developing that model curriculum, and I know that they have done really recently updated the way that they approach social studies and civic education, and I appreciate those more recent efforts. But it seems to me DPI only ever includes educators in what they do.
We're going to get two perspectives on this proposed legislation. Representative Nedweski wasn't available to join us in the conversation today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we need better civics education in schools, more civics education? What to you would that mean? What would it look like? What did you encounter as a student? If you are teaching civics education, either in a separate class or as part of, say, social studies, love to hear your perspective. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tom McCarthy is the Associate Deputy Superintendent at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to this proposed legislation, Tom, I want to talk about what's been going on at the Department of Public Instruction, the DPI, when it comes to civics. The representative referenced it toward the end of that clip there. What has been going on in the DPI when it comes to reviewing how kids are taught about civics?
Quite a bit, actually. We're fortunate in this moment to have a state superintendent who is a former social studies teacher, so has a very tuned in perspective to some of the distinct needs that exist here. So what the department has done under Dr. Underley's leadership is to construct what educators refer to as a scope and sequence. So historically, the department has taken a look and created learning objectives or standards, as we call them, going the next level in to try to assist and remove barriers that districts have where they just don't know how to approach setting additional learning pieces through those standards. We've created a model scope and sequence and have, yes, included educators, but also included a broader community that exists around trying to promote and advance a better civic education for all of our learners.
At this hearing, the DPI registered some concerns about the proposed legislation. What stands out to you as points that you'd want a closer look at?
You know, I think it really comes down to the fact that there are legislative solutions for things where we need to actually change laws. And then there are situations where the legislature is sticking its nose into an area that is unnecessary and possibly potentially hostile, where you are injecting partisan politics into an issue that is incredibly fragile right now in schools and communities across the state. So keeping that lens of nonpartisan, protecting educators, one of the things that we hear a lot about when we talk to social studies teachers, educators that are focused on civics, is that they're sort of paralyzed by fear that the things that they're going to introduce regarding challenging topics will be thrown back in their face if one parent feels like this is not the right move. And that is really counterintuitive to this whole idea of how we function as a democratic society of working through a majority in these systems and structures that are designed to stop a tyranny of the minority from controlling how government should function. So it's really that. It's the idea that you already have a branch of government that is set up and organized to provide this service. In the past couple of years, it's been functioning toward this goal. Why do we need to change statutes and put ourselves into this conversation when there's already good momentum going?
And I think the argument from supporters of the legislation is one way or another, we're falling down when it comes to civics education. Kids aren't coming out of school knowing some of the basics of how our government, our civic institutions work and how to participate. Do you think that's a fair criticism of our current status quo in our schools?
I think that'll always be a criticism until you have 100% proficiency and success for every kid in every state. And we respect that. That's a lofty goal. It's something that we should be stretching to. The question then becomes, how do you get there? And I would argue that by putting through a bill that has no funding, no supports for classroom teachers, and just introduces another mandate in education, adds to an already overfilling list of things that schools are asked to do to serve kids. It doesn't seek to understand why. It doesn't try to figure out what's happened over time, why civics instruction has sort of taken a backseat to reading, math, and science, some of these dominant subjects that have gone through a phase of increased emphasis. And you're left with a lot of social studies teachers that feel like they are not seen, heard, and valued in these conversations about what matters to kids. That is valid. All of those things are valid. Slapping a state mandate is not going to fix that. Restoring the professionalism of educators will begin to fix that. This bill does not do that.
Before I let you go, Tom, there's been some criticism of the bill with phrases like civic pride and patriotism, not the phrases themselves being objectionable, but that they're left kind of undefined as to how they would be instituted. Is that something you worry about?
Absolutely, because it would subject that ideal, how it is implemented, to a small committee of legislators that oversee how rules are managed in agencies. And what we've seen in the past is that is a recipe for injecting partisanship into some of these things on issues that become very hard for adults to agree. And honestly, that's probably one of the biggest objections, because our orientation around this under Dr. Underley's leadership is trying to figure out what works best for kids. A state mandate from the legislature is not going to best serve kids in an area like this.
Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Tom McCarthy is Associate Deputy Superintendent at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, or DPI. He talked to us about what the DPI thinks of a new civics education bill proposed in the Wisconsin legislature. Now an education expert joins us for a look at the current state of civics education in Wisconsin and the most effective ways to teach civic engagement in schools. Diana Hess is Dean of the UW-Madison School of Education and a faculty member in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction. She's principal investigator for the Discussion Project at UW-Madison's Wisconsin Center for Education Research, author of two books on civics and politics in the classroom. Diana, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
Well, we heard there from Tom making the case that until we have 100% proficiency, we're going to have complaints about how well we do with civics education. How do you evaluate, as you look around Wisconsin, how we're doing on civics education for our kids?
Well, I agree with Tom that DPI has a lot going on in civics education, and I'm really impressed by what they're doing. I think where we may disagree is that I do think we need a law that requires a high school civics course in Wisconsin. I don't think this particular law is framed in the way that's going to get us to where we want to go. But what I do like about the law is that it would require every single student in Wisconsin to take a high school civics course. And currently, that is not the case. So we are one of very, very few states in the country without a mandate requiring high school civics. And we know from research that we did a couple of years ago that about 25% of the school districts in Wisconsin do not require their students to take a high school civics course. We think that's about 65,000 students in the state who are not getting any civics in high school, and I think that's really a problem. So I do support a law that would require a really high quality course in high school civics, and I think such a law also needs to be accompanied by some funding that could be used to develop Wisconsin-specific materials that would be used for high-quality professional development. I do find it curious that we had a bipartisan coalition of legislators pass a financial literacy mandate very, very recently that's going to require every student in Wisconsin to take a semester of financial literacy. I'm not suggesting that financial literacy is unimportant, but I don't think it's anywhere near as important as civics. So I've always found it curious that this state, which has this history of really caring about the democratic participation of all people across the aisle, is a state that is not considered one of the hallmarks of civic education. I think we can fix that, and we should.
One argument I've heard along those lines is it's okay if we don't have a specific class as long as we bring civics curriculum into our social studies, maybe our American history classes, things like that. Kids will learn along the way, even without that half credit in their sophomore year or what have you. What's your response to that that argument?
So I was a high school social studies teacher for many years in a school district that did not have a high school civics requirement, and it was really a problem. Because if you were teaching U.S. history, you had plenty to teach. You had plenty to teach in other courses. And even if you cared about civics, it was just never going to get the time and attention that it deserved. So I think the reason we require courses is it's a way for us to say, this is so important that we want to make sure that all students learn what we would like them to learn. And I think if you're asking important content to be infused across the curriculum, the reality is it just gets lost.
We're talking to Diana Hess, Dean of the UW-Madison School of Education, faculty member in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction, talking to her about civics education in Wisconsin, a new civics education bill in the state legislature. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do we need specific civics classes for high school students in Wisconsin? Should that be a law? And then, how do we teach civics? Should patriotism and inculcating patriotism be a part of that? Civic pride, civic engagement. What is civics to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Diana Hess, Dean of the UW-Madison School of Education, Principal Investigator for the Discussion Project at UW-Madison's Wisconsin Center for Education Research, talking about civics education in Wisconsin and a proposed law in the state legislature. Before we go to our callers, Diana, I wanted to ask you about what a civics class should be. People have different visions. It should be to promote patriotism. No, it should be to promote civic engagement and participation. No, it's just the nuts and bolts of how things work. What should it be?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And obviously, there's a lot of debate about what constitutes high quality civics. Conveniently, though, we know that there's been a lot of work done both on the research side and on the curriculum development side to try to come up with agreement on what should be in a high quality civics class. And I think we actually can come to agreement on this. So, for example, I think most people agree that we want to make sure that students learn a lot about the founding principles of the United States. They learn a lot about in significant content. We want them to learn a lot about the Constitution. We want them to learn a lot about how the political system works and what causes the political system to work and what happens when the political system doesn't work. So there needs to be a lot of content. There's no doubt about that. Not content that's kind of drilled into students and memorized and, you know, students just spit it back out on a test. But this kind of content, from my experience as a high school teacher, is content that's really hard to learn. So, for example, to go back to what we heard at the top of the show, the legislator who has introduced this bill is very interested in students learning about the First Amendment. And I'm very interested in students learning about the First Amendment as well. But to really teach students about the First Amendment, it means that they are learning more than just the words of the First Amendment, but they're learning all sorts of things about how the First Amendment has evolved over time, different interpretations of the First Amendment, what happens when principles in the First Amendment conflict with other principles, and so on and so forth. But I think we should first and foremost care a lot about students learning high quality content. We also want to make sure that in really great civics classes, students are learning how to talk about the actual controversial political issues that animate our time, and that they learn how to talk with students who both agree and disagree with them. One of the things that I'm most concerned about is how politically polarized we are in the United States. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that very few people in the United States regularly have the opportunity to talk about important political issues with people who have different views. And I think that's really a problem. And schools are actually a place where we have an opportunity to help students learn that very important skill. So in my view, that's one of the most important things that we should be doing in civic education. And there's ways of doing that that are nonpartisan. And it's incredibly important to make sure that civics classes are nonpartisan. But that doesn't mean that we're not teaching about politics. We absolutely have to teach about politics.
Let's go to our callers now. Liz is with us in Eau Claire. Liz, hi.
Hi there. Should I turn off my radio or what?
I'm not hearing it, so go for it, Liz.
Okay. So my thought is, and my question is, all the things your speaker just said, I sound really good to me. And I have to confess, I don't know the details of law, but quoted in it somewhere, is it possible that a small group of legislatures could be dictating all of the things that are in it and not what the speaker just said?
Liz, I got you. Thanks for the call. You're breaking up a little, but Diana, do you have concerns that legislation could be misused and partisanized to create a more partisan civics class?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges with writing high-quality civics curriculum is we want to make sure the curriculum is fair and balanced, and we want to make sure that the curriculum is not partisan. And for that reason, I'm personally a fan of bills that are bipartisan bills that have been carefully worked out. And one of the concerns I have about this bill, even though I agree with its principal point, which is that we should require a high school civics class, I don't like the fact that the actual details of what will be taught in the civics class were not worked out in a bipartisan way, or better yet, left to people who this is what they do for a living. You know, we've got lots of experts in civic education, both in this state and in other states. A lot of work has been done on how to think about what the content of these classes should be. So in my mind, I don't think it's necessarily appropriate for the legislature to spell out in detail precisely what should happen in these classes. I do think it's important for the legislature to say, we think that all students should take a high school civics class. And by the way, that shouldn't be the first time students are studying civics. Students should be studying civics across their K-12 school experience. And one of the concerns I have is that we know that a lot of civics that used to be taught in elementary school and in middle school is not taught any longer. So that compounds the problem. It's not only that we don't have a required high school course that all school districts offer to all students, but that in many school districts, for a variety of reasons, civics is not being taught in elementary or middle school either.
Thanks for that call, Liz. Chris is with us now in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Hi. So I am, as the guest here is stating, I am happy to defer to educators on the content of these programs. I am not I'm bifurcated on the notion of including patriotism in such a curriculum. That being said, I went through two credits in my high school career as far as civics went, and I found them greatly valuable. And in one instance, we actually developed a county, and we kind of spent a semester doing such a program, and you understood inner workings of executive order and how the law and administration goes into it. So that helped shape me in that context.
Chris, thanks a lot for that. Diana, they made up their own county and ran it as one of his civics classes. What do you think of that kind of hands-on civics education?
Well, it sounds terrific, and we know that the research supports that. Let me tell you a little bit about a civics approach that we see in a number of school districts in Wisconsin called the legislative semester. And it's a civics course where students form a state legislature, and they spend the entire semester proposing bills and investigating them and deliberating them. There are a variety of school districts in the state of Wisconsin that have adopted this. In Middleton, students are required to go through the legislative semester. There are high schools now in Milwaukee that are doing this. In Sauk, it's required. And I've spent a lot of time watching that form of civics, and I am extraordinarily impressed by it. It sounds very similar to what our caller is describing. So the good news is that even though there are about 25% of school districts in Wisconsin that are not currently offering civics classes or requiring them, there are examples of civics classes in Wisconsin that are not only models for our state, but that are actually being watched nationally, that are some of the best civics courses you could find anywhere. So we have really great examples of civics here. We just need to make sure that all students have the opportunity to have high quality civics.
Chris, thanks for the call. In our last minute or so, Diana, I want to ask about the incentive structure. Schools are evaluated on tests of reading and math, maybe sometimes science, but I think not civics very much. Has our school evaluation structure pushed civics to the side in many schools?
Well, I think the focus on testing in math and in English language arts has pushed civics and a lot of social studies, to be fair, out of elementary and middle schools. And I think that's really a problem. You know, I think if we require every student to have civics K-12, including a really strong, robust high school course, and if we provide support to districts and to teachers so they have the professional development they need, you know, I think we would see incredible progress. One of the things we know from research is that high quality civics really makes a difference. And so there's not a big debate about whether or not we should have high quality civics. I think in this state, one of the things that's odd is we're willing to require financial literacy, but we're not willing to require civics. I think that's really a problem. I would like to see that fixed. I don't think it needs to be fixed with this bill per se. I do have some questions about the content of this bill. And again, I want to tip my hat to the work DPI has been doing for the last couple years on civics. We're making progress. But I really encourage everybody who's listening to encourage their state legislators to get serious about getting a great bipartisan bill passed.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Diana Hess, Dean of the UW-Madison School of Education, looking at civics education here in Wisconsin. If you ever look forward to cracking open a cold can of beer, today is a special anniversary for you. The anniversary of the first commercial release of canned beer. As reported at history.com, on this day in 1935, a beer company delivered its first load of 2,000 cans of beer to customers. Where did this happen? Was it close to home? No, it was the Gottfried Kruger Brewing Company in Richmond, Virginia. There were earlier experiments in canned beer production going back for a few decades. Nobody made it work. Then Prohibition came along, so there's no incentive to can the illegal product. The Richmond-based company won the post-Prohibition race to deliver a canned beer. The big names soon followed in their path. By the end of the year, 1935, over 200 million cans of beer were sold. Today, about half of the American beer market moves in canned form. Take one down, pass it around. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a language teacher answers your questions about getting started with a new language and keeping that momentum going. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Green Bay Packers fans have had a tough week coming out of a loss in the playoffs. Despite the crushed dreams following a surprising season, it's likely that most fans will stay loyal to the green and gold no matter what. WPR's Tyler Ditter has a story about that devotion.
Green Bay Packers fans are a proud community. It's not just the tailgating and freezing temperatures or the adrenaline rush of witnessing a Hail Mary, but fans love that their team is the only publicly owned NFL team. Mary Jane Herber and Molly Schrader talked about this as part of a StoryCorps mobile tour stop in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Back in the early 90s, when they were talking about doing the referendum for the stadium to be expanded, and people would say to me, "You're not going to vote for that?" And I'd say, "Yes, I am." And they'd say, "Why?" And I picked out a community in the Midwest, state capital, same size. The people in that community, the businessmen in that community, would give anything to be able to say, "I'm from XYZ, and it's the home of the Packers." It opens a business door. Whether the Packers are playing well or poorly, there's still that door. Oh, Vince Lombardi. Oh, Brett Favre. Oh, Bart Starr. It opens that door for business because people know where Green Bay is.
And I think it's pretty cool, too, that, like, anyone can be an owner. I got my ownership certificate, what, like, a year ago?
Your stock certificate?
Yeah, my stock. I don't even know what I'm talking about. And I got it as a president. And I was like, "Look at me. I'm finally an owner." So I can, like, walk in and I'm meeting people from across the country and be like, "Yep, I'm one of the owners of the Green Bay Packers. No big deal."
So am I. So am I. I'm an owner of the Green Bay Packers. I have one share.
Me too.
You know, I'm one share. And, you know, my family is so conservative in terms of, you know, we just don't spend money wildly. And my mother had the catalog for the pro shop on her kitchen table. And I said, "Where did you get this?" "I guess I probably got it because I bought a share of stock when it was for sale." This was back in the 90s. I said, "You bought a share? I bought a share. My brother bought a share." None of us told each other that we bought stock because we were all afraid that the other person was going to say to us, "You what?" Because it doesn't pay any dividend. You can't sell it. You can only give it to a relative. It doesn't move you up on the season ticket list. It does nothing other than to make sure that the Green Bay Packers stay in Green Bay, Wisconsin. But that team would be gone if there had been a sole owner. It's the businessmen of this community in the 20s and the 30s and the 50s and the 60s that made sure, you know, and that executive committee of maybe 9 people on the committee, and then there's 40 people on the board as a whole. Lots of judges and women in business. When we had Antiques Roadshow here back in 2017, somebody was sitting at a table for lunch, and some of the executive producer and stuff for the Antiques Roadshow came over and sat down with them, and they got talking about Packer stock. And she said, "You don't get a dividend? No. You don't get moved up the list? No. I'm going to have to go back to Boston and have my husband explain this to me." Because it made no sense to her that people would plunk down $100. I think the last time it was $200 or $300 for a share. I don't know. I know it went up from the $100 my mother and I paid.
Yeah, I don't think it was $100.
No, I think it went up to $2.
Yeah.
I think. I'm not sure. You know, people, what happened to the money? Well, they use it to work on the stadium and do things to keep things up to speed, and that it's one of the best places in the world to view sports. That's what they always say. You know, Roland Garros for the French Open. You know, there's other places that you want to be, and Lambeau Field is one of them.
That was Brown County librarians Mary Jane Herber and Molly Schrader. Their interviews were recorded at StoryCorps, a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of WPR and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
This is Central Time. We're a few weeks into the new year and just getting started with our New Year's resolutions, if any. Maybe you made a commitment to learn a new language or dust off those skills in a particular language you already tried learning once upon a time. Diving into a new language can be fun and rewarding. It also comes with challenges. Our next guest is here to help us get started on the right foot with advice for beginners and experienced language learners of all ages. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you speak a second language or third or fourth? How did you get started? What made it work for you? Or if you're more like me, what made it not work for you? What were some of the challenges that got in your way? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Any language teachers out there, love to hear from you too. That's 800-642-1234. Jessica Miller is a professor of languages at UW-Eau Claire, where she teaches all levels of French. She was recently named the 2024 Teacher of the Year by the Wisconsin Association for Language Teachers. Jessica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Start off, Jessica, by inspiring us with your own language story, you learning your second and then next few languages along the way.
All right. So I grew up in France, in Strasbourg, which is one of 3 capitals of Europe. It's right on the German border. So I was exposed to lots of different languages at an early age. And it all started in school, really, where I started taking German and then English. And I was always interested in English because in France, we hear a lot of English language music on the radio. And I was very annoyed that I didn't understand the lyrics. And after that, I just kept going because, you know, once you know how to learn another language, then each new language becomes easier because you've developed a toolkit.
What inspired you to become a language teacher?
I sort of fell into it, I guess. I was very interested in linguistics, so I went to grad school for linguistics. And then I started teaching as a grad student, and I found that I wasn't too bad at it, and I really enjoyed the contact with students and sharing my passion for learning languages with them.
Well, you're the Wisconsin Language Teacher of the Year, so let's get some advice from you now. Say you've got somebody, a random person who tries different ways to learn languages, but feels like he or she isn't very good at it and is a little nervous about trying to speak it. How could somebody like that, okay, it's me, how could somebody like that get started?
I think the first thing to do is identify your goal or your goals. Why are you interested in learning a language? Is it, you know, just to get your, you know, your brain exercising, or are you going to travel, or is there someone that you met that you want to talk to? And that's really important because that's going to give you the motivation. Secondly, is adjust your expectations. Learning a language takes time. So there is gratification at the beginning, you know, because when you start from knowing nothing and then you learn 10 words, you know, that's that's huge. But then the more you get the language, the slower it's going to feel. And that's where the motivation can decrease. And I think, you know, just like any New Year's resolution, or, you know, if you want to exercise more, you need to make it part of your routine. You need to make it easy for you to, you know, to have the opportunity to practice, and a little bit every day goes a long way. And another piece of advice is to look for support. Learning a language is really social. You know, that's why we learn languages. That's why we use them, is to communicate with people. So I would recommend looking for other people who are learning languages to motivate each other, and maybe even, you know, group of people who know the target language to help you practice it.
And as I understand it, a key part of your classroom, if somebody's your student, Jessica, they're going to talk, and there's a lot of conversation in that language, and that's a big part of learning. Why is that so important?
Yeah, that's really important, because when you speak, you're actively using the language. So there are passive ways to study a language, you know, like reading or watching videos, but it's totally different to actively be using it, and it's more difficult. But that's really, you know, real life context where you're going to need to use the language to, for example, you know, to talk to people, to do your shopping, to order at a restaurant. So it's important that students practice speaking the language in class.
Jessica Miller is with us, professor of French language at UW-Eau Claire. She's with us today to talk about learning a new language and share some advice on how to get started and how to keep going. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear your stories. Do you use a language learning app like Duolingo or Rosetta Stone? What has your experience been like? Did you learn languages in classes? What took, what didn't? Did you live in a place where you had no choice but to learn that second or third language? How did it go? Join in with your experiences or your questions at 800-642-1234. Are you learning another language right now? 800-642-1234. If you're learning English, am I helping you? Do you listen to this show to learn English? 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about learning a new language with language professor Jessica Miller from UW-Eau Claire. Hoping to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What language or languages have you learned in addition to the one you started with, whether that was English or English was your second language? What, if you were successful, what worked for you? What, is there a teacher you want to give a shout out to who did a real good job of helping you learn that language? Was it finding somebody to talk to? Was it an app, a book, a video? Tell us all about it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Used to get a lot of callers who love to talk about their second languages. Maybe nobody's doing it anymore. I don't know. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Jessica, we were just talking about the importance of having conversations. I'll admit, and I know I'm not alone, I can do the book learning side of it. And then when it goes to actually talking, I feel a disproportionate level of anxiety and fear. And I understand, you know, even though you're a pro, you've been through this yourself. How do we overcome that hesitancy to speak that second language?
I think it's by setting your goal, and you know, you just got to do what it takes to reach your objective. It's hard because when you talk spontaneously, you're really putting yourself in a vulnerable position. And as a second language, you don't have full control of what you say or how you're going to be perceived. But then you get real life feedback. I have a story about that. When I was learning English, and I was a teenager, I traveled to the United States. And I love ice cream. So I went to get some ice cream and I saw a flavor. I had no idea what it was, but it looked interesting. And I ordered cookie Duff.
That's English for you.
Right. Because, you know, rough, tough, Duff. And then I don't know. They didn't understand me. So I repeated it. They didn't understand me. So then I was very, you know, I wanted my ice cream, so I just ended up pointing, and I got my ice cream, and the person who scooped said, "Oh, cookie dough." So I got instant feedback, and I learned so much, and I got ice cream on top of it. But it's, you know, just the type of situation that happens, and you just have to laugh about it and say, okay, I'm learning, I'm communicating.
And nobody's really judging you, I think, when you say cookie Duff on that first try instead of cookie dough, right?
Right, because that's just, yeah, it's just speaking. You know, even in our native language, we make mistakes. And language changes, too. So there's always something new to be learning.
We heard from Frank in Springbrook. Frank has tried to learn Spanish, German, Korean. He can't hear what native speakers are saying because they talk fast, hard to decipher native speakers. Same with English, I guess. How do you get to that point? And this is a challenge. Frank's not alone there. This is a challenge for me, too. If I've been working on Spanish on an app for a while, if I get somebody to talk pretty slow, I can mostly keep up. But real life language, how do we get to being able to talk at that speed?
I think, first of all, you know, if you watch YouTube videos, you can slow those down if it helps. But it's true that in the end, you do want to be able to understand speakers at faster speaking rates. I think you just have to give up the goal to understand every detail. Try to go for the gist, you know, what did you understand? It's not because you missed some words that you're not going to understand the point of the story that, you know, someone is telling. So that would be my advice. In my classes, I always make sure that I use authentic resources. So that means material that's not specifically made for learners, but made, you know, for everybody, just so students get to practice listening, you know, at the fast speech. And then you get used to it and you get used to not understanding everything. And you still get a lot out of, you know, you get a few details here and there, and often that's enough.
Thanks for sending that along, Frank. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Laura is with us in Madison. Laura, hi.
Hi, Rob, and thanks to your guest. I just wanted to make the comment that I've been learning Spanish for about 20 years, and what I've found is that it really helps to learn the verbs. You know, a lot of times you just concentrate on, like, learning the nouns, the objects, but you can always describe an object, but it turns out, like, in your everyday speaking, you're describing what you're doing or you're trying to tell a story, and that's when knowing what those verbs are is really important.
Laura, thanks a lot. Jessica, how do we it's easy to make that list of, you know, table, door, library, things like that. The importance of getting those actions, those verbs.
Right. Yeah. Thank you, Laura. Yeah, it's very important, right, because you're going to, you know, describe some actions. So what you can do to learn some verbs is to look up online, you know, the 100 most frequent verbs in the language you're studying, and you'll get some useful lists there. And you can also organize them, try to look for verbs that are meaningful to you. Don't simply learn lists, but try to decide what are 10 verbs that I use frequently that would be useful personally to me, and then start by memorizing those.
Laura, thanks a lot for the call. Jane is with us now in Waukesha. Jane, hi.
Hi. I was talking about learning a language like in a classroom, and I felt very self-conscious. A lot of times we'd sit in a circle and look at each other, and it's like, but when I went on vacation and I purposefully used words and would ask people to help me, and especially little children, I learned a lot because we were in Costa Rica during the rainy season, and I would just sit down under the palapa, and this little 8-year-old we'd get a magazine out and I'd circle things and she'd write it in Spanish and I'd write it in English and then we'd pronounce it and we just had a lot of fun. And then she drew mustaches on all the women, but it was.
Jane, thanks a lot. Talking to kids, Jessica, and also kids' books, the vocabulary tends to be a little more limited. That could be a good starting point, I've found anyway, in trying to read another language. The value of communicating with children to help learn a language. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a great story. And I really like that, Jane tried to use her Spanish while she was abroad. And children, they don't judge. They just want to have fun. And I think when you also approach language learning as something fun, that makes a difference, too, because you're more likely to stick with it.
Mona, thanks a lot for the call. Dana joins us now in West Bend. Dana, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I really like this topic. One thing that I found beneficial, going back to, your previous caller about, how to kind of keep up with the conversation, or if you're watching a TV show or something like that, I have really found, even in my own native language of English, that putting on the closed caption or subtitles has been very, very helpful to, especially as you're trying to, speed up your own learning or speed up your own conversation style back. I've found that to be very, very helpful because
Dana, I gotcha. We're just about out of time. And Jessica, I'll ask you, let's pick your native language of French. For an English speaker learning French, can you recommend a movie we could watch with or without subtitles?
I think I would recommend series on Netflix. There are some really good series. And, then you're just set for hours of exposure to French. I'm blanking on the title, but there's a really good one, Lupin, L-U-P-I-N, that I would recommend.
All right. Thanks for that call, Dana. And Jessica, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's Jessica Miller, professor of languages at UW-Eau Claire, where she teaches all levels of French. She was recently named the 2024 Teacher of the Year by the Wisconsin Association for Language Teachers. She's been giving us advice for picking up a new language or brushing up our skills. You can keep the conversation going. Share your language story. What went well? What didn't? You can email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, what is at stake in the presidential election when it comes to healthcare and healthcare coverage? Longtime health reporter Julie Rovner joins us. We'll dig into the platforms from candidates and parties and what it all means for you. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.